guys, welcome to Not Another Anxiety Show. I'm your host, Kelly Walker, and joining me today is the busy mind psychologist, Dr. Jessica Borshak, who helps people get unstuck from their busy minds so they can be their best self. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm so excited for this conversation.
I know. People are going to love it. It's going to be very valuable. At least I know it's going to be valuable for me.
It's been valuable for me, trust me.
Now, I was hoping, can you start by telling us a little bit about what a busy mind might look like? Because I imagine it can show up in different costumes that we're not necessarily aware of. At least I know I wasn't.
Of course. I mean, listen, our minds are sneaky. And a lot of times we don't know when we're kind of caught up in our head or caught up in that pattern of just getting sucked down that rabbit hole. Busy minds, I like to think of it as if you're having those moments anytime your mind is being taken out of the present moment. If you're having a lot of like what if thoughts, like what if this happens, or you find yourself reflecting on past experiences, tearing apart those experiences, going over it well past the point where it's helpful, because that's the important piece. There are times when being in your head, problem solving, analyzing, planning is super helpful, and it's a skill that we want to have. But then there's a point where it's no longer helpful and it just feeds our anxiety. When we're worrying about something for the 10th time, when we find ourselves getting really caught up in like shoulds, like, oh, I should do this, or I have to do this, or what if? And those are kind of little clues to me that I'm getting sucked into my mind and my mind's starting to kind of just do busy work instead of serving me.
Okay. So that's how we can start to discern, like the shoulds, have tos, and what ifs can be clues or flags to help us discern, all right, this may have crossed the line from helpful, productive, supportive, resourceful to, counterproductive.
Exactly.
Okay, great. Now, can you tell us also, how did you come to be in this niche of helping people get unstuck from their busy minds? Is there a personal piece of your journey that played a part in developing your current niche here?
Of course there is. Of course. Listen, I have the busiest mind in the entire world when I'm just in my natural default state. I'm a problem solver. I like thinking thoughts. I like, thinking through different scenarios. I find it really enjoyable. And yet I've gone through a couple of scenarios in my life where I've struggled with mental health, and the busy mind has just gotten a little bit out of control. And I've been in this state where I felt like my mind was controlling what's happening in my life instead of me. So back when I was early teens, late 20s, I struggled with OCD. Now, a lot of times when people think of OCD, they think of like excessive hand washing and concerns around germs. But my OCD was much more surrounded by safety. So in the evenings, I would do things like check the locks 10 times, make sure there, no one was in my room. Just a lot of almost kind of paranoia type thoughts around safety and around making sure that I was doing everything I could to make sure that I was safe. And unfortunately, what ends up happening is your mind starts going, well, what if this? What if someone somehow snuck into your room? What if, even though you checked that the stove was off, it really wasn't? And those thoughts would then feed all of these behaviors because I'd get so overwhelmed, so anxious in response to them. It's like, oh, well, what if? I mean, it just takes 2 minutes to go check the stove and make sure that it's turned off. But if I don't check it, the house could burn down. And so that was my first experience of seeing how that good analytical part of my mind could kind of be used against me. And I went to therapy for a couple of sessions. I did I did exposure plus response prevention, which is the most common treatment for OCD. And I'm happy to say it hasn't been an issue in my life for about 8 years, which is really great. It still pops up from time to time, but I'm now in control of how I respond to it. And I think that's the key. It's not necessarily that we'll ever permanently delete these types of thoughts, but as long as we're not feeding them, they're not, we get to decide what happens next.
I like that because I think I read something like 95% of the population will have intrusive, unwanted, like unsettling thoughts. Like those are not abnormal, but a lot of times we misinterpret it as such. And then it obviously can be quite easy to get stuck in it or run away with it. But I like that you kind of say that these thoughts really are to be expected almost in the human experience.
The one I find that most people have a lot is, I guess there are two. So if you're ever driving your car and you've ever had this thought, like, what if I just like veered the car and oncoming traffic?
Yep.
And most people have the immediate response of like, well, that's not a good idea.
Right.
And the other one is if you've ever looked over a very tall like height, like you look over
hiking. This has happened to me at the top of a cliff. You look over and like, what if I jump? Right.
Yeah. And it's not it's important to remember because people sometimes then they grab that thought and they, you know, jump down a mental rabbit hole, just like we jump down an internet rabbit hole. And before we know it, we're on like our 18th YouTube video. We jump down this mental rabbit hole and we just kind of follow these thoughts wherever they lead. And if we have this thought and we don't realize that like, yeah, sometimes your mind just says weird stuff.
Yeah.
And we think like, oh my God, am I depressed? Am I suicidal? Like, does this mean that something's wrong in my life? And we end up responding to it in a way that causes more distress in our life instead of just noticing that our mind is naturally curious and it's going to pop up with random things from time to time. And that doesn't mean that our thoughts have to predict our behaviors. We get to choose how we respond to them.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, that is really empowering. So it sounds like your personal experience really kind of shaped this role, this like cool niche that you're in right now. And I mean, not uncommon, but it sounds like, am I kind of right in saying that? Like, it sounds like your personal experience and personal growth really helped sort of just, create this cool niche.
Yes, definitely. And honestly, the last 2 to 3 years I've been struggling. I had a trauma in a romantic relationship and I'm not going to go into detail on that since no trigger warnings, but I was struggling with PTSD as a result of that. And that was really difficult to me because, you know, I thought like, hey, I've done the work. I got the mindset. I understand how the mind works. Like I have a PhD in psychology. You know, I can just like problem solve my way through it. I can self-care my way through this issue. And some of the things I really love about me, my drive, how hardworking I am, my curiosity ended up kind of working against me. And I had this place where I got to this point and I had to realize like, you need to do something different because you can't, the more you try to control this situation, the worse your symptoms get. And I actually took a break from work. I left work and it was the best thing I could have done for myself. And so as I started coming back to work and I thought about, you know, what was most helpful? Yes, I mean, therapy for sure, PTSD, like trauma work. But at the same time, it was helping me to acknowledge that, one, it's okay to ask for help, that we can't control everything, even if we want to, and even if we have all of the knowledge and the skills, that's not how minds work. Yep. As much as we want it to.
As much as we want it to.
Yes. Well, we're the only species that if something doesn't work, we like double down and try harder.
I know.
Every other species is like, oh, let me try this other thing instead. But we're like, I just must not be good enough at, you know, dealing with my thoughts. And it's like, no, the approach that you have trying to delete permanently your thoughts is a losing battle. And the more we try to force that to happen, the more sucked into this cycle we get and the more avoidant we get. So we end up, we're feeling all this unpleasant stuff inside of us. We try to do all these things to get away from it, whether it's getting in our mind, thinking lots of thoughts, whether it's like productive procrastination. So suddenly needing to clean out the fridge, that's always a big clue that we need to pause and recognize what's going on.
If I'm washing my walls, that's like, it's time to tune in. Like when I'm looking at my walls, like, ooh, let's get the magic eraser and get every scratch. Like, okay, yeah, so let's tune in a little bit here.
exactly, right? Those are some good clues that like, hey, we're trying to problem solve our way out of a situation where we need a little bit more compassion towards ourselves and a little bit more acknowledgement that sometimes this stuff shows up and we don't have to like it, but we do have to acknowledge it's there and approach it in a way that allows us to decide how we respond to it.
Yeah. I think, and that's key. And I can really relate to some of your personal experience, because I was actually diagnosed with OCD when I was like 12. And for me, it showed up like a lot of physical compulsions, but also like a lot of ruminating and replant, like a lot of like cognitive compulsions, it almost felt like. And yeah, especially health anxiety, like health checks, rechecking. And you know, as a person that struggled with OCD too and panic attacks, thoughts can be, oh my gosh, very addicting. And it feels compulsory to engage them through like several means, like whether it's suppression, reframing, ruminating, and more, to find that place of peace or relief. And I know originally traditional CBT encouraged me to change my anxious thoughts, which led to an even bigger internal battle and more tension and more struggle and suffering. Yeah. And I'm wondering, we've touched on this on the show a little bit, but I'm wondering, like, why didn't this work for me? And am I alone in this?
So you are not alone at all. And so, I guess a brief little background. So the type of therapy I do is called acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT. And it focuses on the same things that CBT does, like our cognitions, our thoughts, and our behaviors, but it does so in a slightly different way. So traditional CBT takes this approach, as you said, that we can change our thoughts. The difficulty with that is that's not actually how the brain works. Our mind creates neural connections between things. And the more that we pay attention to those connections, the more that we like retrieve them, we think through them, we engage with them in some way, the stronger those connections get. And those connections don't really, like, we don't press a delete button or drag it into the trash can and it just goes away forever.
So we're just fighting the way our brain naturally works, it sounds like.
Exactly. And so what I think more modern CBT or more modern ways of approaching our thoughts are is what we're actually doing, for example, when we do cognitive restructuring, is we're actually creating a new neural pathway. We're creating one pathway where we have this one thought in response to something. And let's say, you know, we have a health scare and we have this, you know, one thought where we go down the health anxiety route. And then we're creating a new thought that might be a little bit more balanced. But if we don't acknowledge that that other thought is still there, or we can only move forward in life when that other thought is never there anymore, we're going to be unsuccessful. And unfortunately, what ends up happening is you feel like it's your fault. Like you're a failure. You're not doing it right. Whatever.
Personal accountability, right? Like, and it's really just a misunderstanding of how the brain works. And we're taking it as this personal failing. And it's like, well, no, we're working against this, you know, like basically the principles of neuroplasticity here. Yes. Like, it's like, oh yeah. And then we feel like such a failure and it's like such a lack of understanding. Like, no, it's just how our brains work, right?
Yeah. Like if we're giving ourselves a pep talk. So let's say I do public speaking, I give trainings, I give workshops, not right now, but I do those. And I always get nervous right beforehand. Once I get on stage, I've had enough learning history that I feel fairly confident, and every once in a while, a little bit of those nerves pop back up. But for the most part, I've done it enough times now that once I get started, I kind of settle in. So my approach isn't to be like, you're not nervous, you're excited, everything's going to be fine. I pause there for a moment and I'm like, all right, I'm feeling nervous. And I feel nervous because this matters to me. And as soon as I can connect it to something that's important to me, all of a sudden the nerves don't seem that scary. Sure, doesn't feel good in my body, would like not to have them. But if the only way I'm not going to have them is if I stop caring about this, then I want to have those nerves. And as soon as we can, and we might call it a reframing, we might call it connecting with, you know, to get all jargony, like distal reinforcers, but essentially connecting with something that matters to us in the long term, like acceptance, just like acknowledging what's there and being willing to sit with it, however you want it, whatever words you want to use or ever you want to think about it. What we're doing is we're acknowledging our reality and we're saying like, I still want to move forward in a different direction. I don't want to listen to what our mind is telling us.
Yeah, that makes sense because I think about, so I have twin 2.5-year-olds and I think about how when they're really like, they're starting to experience fear for the first time, really like they're imaginative enough now where like they can be like, is there something under my bed? Like, yeah. Did I hear something? Like they're imaginative enough now where they're starting to feel this experience of fear more or like the loud vacuum or whatever. And I think about how, when they're getting dysregulated and they're afraid, like if I don't acknowledge their experience and like get down on their level or be present with them and give them hugs, like it just escalates, yeah. Honestly, like not acknowledging their experience just escalates and trying to sort of bring in logic, like that doesn't work either. When they're like, I don't care that statistically speaking, there's a 0% chance this is a monster.
Yeah.
Like it feels right. Like, and I think about how like if there's that sweet spot of like acknowledging, being present with, and sort of just taking, putting one foot in front of the other towards something meaningful, you know, like, I'm like, well, do you want to look under your bed or, you know, do we want to get a pal to snuggle? And they'll be like, yeah, you know, I love my best pal. And like they move through it with a lot of ease, but it's a great lesson in sort of like what works when we're feeling scared and anxious and not acknowledging, which a lot of times we don't want to. Like fear and anxiety can be painful and terrifying and overwhelming. Yes. It's like sometimes we're like, nope, we have our blinders on and we don't even want to take the first step to acknowledge it. But yeah, I think it's so helpful and, you know, ultimately it's so helpful in like moving forward.
And I always like, I loved that point you made about like logic and reason isn't going to work here because something that's been really helpful for me is thinking about like our minds are the best lawyers that exist in the entire world.
Seriously.
You are like not
creative lawyers. Like we're not going to out-lawyer our mind.
Yes. We are not going to out-argue our mind. It's never going to happen. We are bound by the rules of reality. Our mind is not.
Like your mind has free creative license. It can go wherever it wants, right? And it's so powerful too.
And it feeds that fear. And honestly, it does it for a reason. Like our minds are threat detection systems. Its purpose is to scan for threats. And when there's not an immediate threat in front of us, right? When there's not like a lion, tiger, bear coming at us, when we're not like walking down a dark alley and we have to pay attention to what's going on, which I don't recommend, by the way. Our mind, it's not useful from a survival standpoint for our mind to focus on the present moment. Like if you're having a nice moment with your family or with your friends or by yourself, it's not useful from a survival standpoint to focus on the present moment. So your mind is going to try to get out in front of potential problems and identify like, well, what could go wrong? And again, because they're not limited by reality or time or space or anything like that, there's always an answer.
Yep.
And so what you did with your kids is they were experiencing fear and you were able to show them through your behaviors, through your tone, that alarm bell ringing in their head that's saying there's a monster under the bed. We don't need to listen to that anymore. You know, mom's showing me that this is a safe place. And so the next time that alarm bell rings, we're going to remember, like, no, like mommy said, if I snuggle with a stuffy or, you know, I can check under the bed once, but you know, they can't hide. Then we learn to stop listening to that alarm bell. And unfortunately, we don't have, as adults, as supportive environments. It's kind of like once we hit adulthood, it's like, well, you just have to suck it up and deal with it.
Oh, I know, right? Like, just pull your bootstraps up and yep.
Exactly. Instead of saying like, hey, it's normal to worry about this stuff. It's normal to feel fear or anxiety. It's normal to feel panic sometimes. And if we can create that same process inside of ourselves, which requires us to pause and acknowledge that that fear or anxiety is there, remind ourselves that, you know, anxiety's never killed us before. It's just unpleasant. There's a difference between being threatening and being horribly uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And if we can acknowledge that, then we can continue on with our lives in a way that's meaningful to us. And over time, it trains our mind to not listen to those alarm bells as loudly, but they'll still pop up from time to time.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, do you have like any favorite sort of exercises or tools you personally use for cultivating this skill of unsticking a busy mind? Like you kind of already mentioned one, and it's something that I've used intuitively. Like, I have medical trauma, so sometimes going to the doctors, even for a physical annual or like waiting for blood results, like that's something where some anxiety will arise for me. Not necessarily every time, but sometimes that anxiety, I will feel it in my body. I'll feel anticipation and I'll feel sort of the gurgling stomach and all that stuff. And something that helps me is sort of what you described, is acknowledging, you know what, this fear is here and it's only because I care about my health. Like, I care about my health. I care about being here for my kids and having a quality life. I've been sick enough where my life has lacked significant quality. And, you know, I really value, you know, something is meaningful here for me. And so, of course, there's an opportunity for fear to arise when something we value or is meaningful to us feels threatened, right? Or at stake. And so for me, it's like sort of acknowledging that and expanding a little bit, sort of like, well, you know what? I also really value tending to my health and taking care of my health. So even though I'm scared and get like almost like a bit of performance anxiety, I'm like, I just want to put one foot in front of the other, like take what supports me and ask for help if I need it, or slow things down or ask for what I need, but sort of acknowledging, well, this is also important to me because I do value my health and I want to take care of it. And also, I need this to move forward in my schooling program for like becoming a nurse practitioner. Like, this is something that I have to do for several values, and sort of acknowledging that bigger, more meaningful piece sometimes expands the experience a little bit so that there's almost more room for the anxiety. But are there any other sort of exercises or tools that you personally like or use with clients?
First of all, I just love how you're like living the work. I think that's beautiful and wonderful. And it's so nice to hear that, you know, oh, I'm perfect and I don't have any problems at all.
Oh God, no, jeez. Yeah, right.
I feel like there's this expectation or belief sometimes. Like, I'm always the first one to say, like, listen, I'm right there in the boat with you. So yes, there are a couple of little skills that I like using, and then there's a tool. So I'll kind of walk through the skills first. So one of the things is what you said, is being able to connect your experience to something that's meaningful to you. Sometimes just sitting with, I've noticed a lot of times if we have a history of feeling anxiety or fear or panic, if you've ever had a panic attack and you start noticing those symptoms coming up, your mind does that, oh no.
And it, oh no, here we go again.
Yes. And yeah. It ends up ramping up that experience. And so sometimes we become very reactive to these labels. But really what labels are, is they're just a quick way to reference a collection of experiences. And so if I'm noticing that I'm experiencing, let's say, anxiety or nerves, I might pause and ask myself, yeah, but like, what am I actually experiencing. Okay, I'm feeling a little bit sweaty. Like I'm feeling, you know, my neck's a bit sweaty. My hair is getting a little bit damp. I have that kind of like gnawing butterfly feeling in my stomach. Like, okay, I've had that before. It's small. I've noticed that I feel like I have like a lot of energy that's kind of like jagged, like running, bouncing around through my body. It's like, okay. And when we can identify the specific experiences, the actual experiences, we start to, as you mentioned, create space for that. Because while those experiences are uncomfortable, they're a lot less scary or threatening than this label of like panic, anxiety. Yeah. And then once we've kind of broken that down a little bit, and again, I just did that in, you know, 5 seconds. We're not spending 30 minutes going through a detailed analysis of what our body's saying. we're slowing down and just giving a quick overview. And then being able to pause and say like, okay, what's meaningful to me in this moment? Like, why does this moment matter to me? And that can again help you connect with and get a new perspective on why you're feeling this. So as you said, you know, I'm nervous because my health is important to me, and I want to have that independence, and I want to live a long life and connect with my kids and live a life of meaning. The first thing, though, is we can't do any of this if we're not aware of what we're feeling.
It really is half the work, isn't it? Just
and this is a step that people surprisingly skip a lot, because if we're spending so much time stuck in our heads, what we're not doing is actually being present. Because normally, if we're doing, like, if we're thinking, like, what if, like, you know, my heart's pounding. Like, what if I'm going to have a panic attack? What if this is going to happen? What if I get, you know, test results back that I don't like? Well, those things all happen in the future. So if your mind is in the future, it can't be paying attention to what's happening right now. So the first step is really cultivating a practice of checking in with yourself and just saying like, what thoughts are in my head? What feelings am I feeling? What sensations are in my body? And I recommend doing this a couple of times a day. Again, takes no more than like 10 to 15 seconds, maybe 30 seconds.
We don't have to find a dark room and allocate an extra half hour for so many of us that are time scarce. Like, it sounds like we can really just integrate it into our day. So if we're, especially now, right, in the pandemic, like some parents are playing the role of teacher, full-time worker, caregiver, right? Like, yeah. So this is nice. It's refreshing to hear something that we can just sort of integrate quickly into what can be an already pretty crazy day for so many of us.
Yes. You don't need to be in a quiet space. No yoga pants need to be put on. You don't need to listen to an app. And we certainly can. Like, I use Headspace almost every night. I've been using it for years. I just use their like free version and listen to their 10-minute meditations that focus on the breath and do a body scan. Like, you can definitely do those stuff. But for some people, that is inaccessible, whether because of time or they come in too full contact with their experience and it becomes
too intense, right? Like, I do a formal meditation now, and that was kind of like a question I wanted to piggyback off. Like, sometimes, I know, especially like as someone that's had panic attacks, when it's that 10 out of 10 and you feel like you're dying, sometimes it doesn't feel like just anxiety. Sometimes it's tricky in that, like, oh no, it's definitely a heart attack this time, or like, it's definitely like, whatever the mind comes up with in that moment. And I'm wondering if, again, coming back to that personal accountability, like, I'm guessing there's going to be some moments where sort of using these, tools, right, or exercises may just be inaccessible. And is that okay?
That is 100% okay.
Okay.
First of all, as a tiny side story, I have friends who are psychologists who have presented to the ER convinced they were having a heart attack, but were having a panic attack.
That's me. I'm SN in nursing, and I went to the emergency room like 3 times in the thick of my anxiety because I was like, no, 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 you're missing it.
A lot of people experience that and they feel embarrassment afterwards. There's no need to feel embarrassed. It's a very intense experience. And if you've never had it before, or if it's at like a level you've never had it before, it's understandable to immediately think something's wrong. Yeah. And then yes, our goal is to learn an approach or a framework for how we experience our thoughts, feelings, memories, sensations, and then how that impacts how we act in the world. And then to develop some tools around it. But not every tool is going to be appropriate at every moment. We might have a really good hammer, but if there's not a nail in front of us, it's not super helpful. And just from a personal standpoint, when I was experiencing really bad trauma symptoms, I had had a regular meditation practice, mindfulness practice for about 2 years. And I was at a point where I wasn't doing it every day, but maybe 4 or 5 times a week. And as soon as my trauma symptoms started getting really bad, I had to make this decision to stop, because every time I practiced it, it would send me into a panic attack. I'd be overwhelmed. I would get like extremely nauseous and like I couldn't eat. And it wasn't serving me. I was aware of what was going on. It's not like I needed to practice being present. And so what I would do instead is, where I used to live, there was a little lake right outside of my apartment complex. And so I would put in my headphones and I wouldn't even put on music. I just wanted to decrease the stimulation.
Yeah,
exactly. Because I just felt so overwhelmed inside of my body. And I would put on my sunglasses so I didn't have to like make eye contact with people. I'd kind of keep my head down a little bit. And I would just walk laps around this lake and I'd smile at all the pups that went by. and I'd watch the ducks swimming around in the lake. And that was my way of practicing being present, but
in a safe way, right? Like in a doable, and it sounds like as important as cultivating these skills to unstick our mind is, it sounds like bringing a tone of or feel of flexibility, like meeting ourselves where we're at. And if like we can't use a certain exercise or tool in a moment, it's totally okay to switch gears to whatever is supportive in that moment.
Yeah, I would even go a step farther and say it's not only okay, it's necessary.
Yeah.
If we get into a habit of always pulling out the hammer, for example, even if the hammer works 85% of the time, that's not going to serve us, because one, that's actually a mindless action. We've trained our mind that that's our new default skill.
Yes.
But what we want to be doing is pausing, taking quick stock of the situation, and then looking at our tool belt and being like, all right, which one are we pulling out?
So making sort of like a more intentional, mindful, deliberate decision. And I guess that's right. What the skill of mindfulness helps us do, like tune into any moment and access that sort of inner wisdom, right? And bring that flexibility, like, okay, this is what makes sense here. This is what makes sense here. And I know as someone that's struggled, especially with OCD, but anxiety in general, it's so easy to like access those tools from a rigid place, like, okay, this is what I do here. And it's like, well, as important as those tools are, it's sort of how we use them with that mindful intention, that sort of taking a second to bring curiosity and take stock, like, yeah, but what actually makes sense here right now, given where I'm at?
Yes. I like to think about it as things aren't good or bad or right or wrong. It's like what works in a given situation. So there are some times where, you know what, I'm like, I'm checking out. I'm taking a deep dive into my busy mind and I'm like going off in daydream land. And you know,
yep.
Sometimes that's helpful for me. Sometimes I finish some work, I could do more stuff, or I've been in a social situation for a little and I'm kind of like hanging out in the corner because I'm feeling overstimulated. And I'm just going to go to fantasy land in my head and space out for 15, 30 minutes. And that is exactly what I need. So
exactly,
you know, playing in our mind or getting caught up in our busy mind isn't, again,
inherently bad, right? Yeah. Like it's not inherently bad.
You should never do it. And same with mindfulness. Like our goal is to not be mindful all the time. Oh my, that would take so much effort to just constantly be present.
Yes. That could become a struggle in and of itself, right?
Of course.
Like, yeah.
Of course. We space out, we have these shortcuts, we have defaults because it saves our energy.
And mind wandering is helpful, right? Regarding creativity and things like that. Like mm-hmm. It's not a necessarily negative brain space. It's just sort of knowing when it's serving us and when it's not, and developing that sort of flexibility and agility to unstick when it's time.
Yes. That's why that awareness piece is important, so that we can say, hey, I could do these different things, and now I'm choosing which one is best for me. So we're not like all in our heads or all being like totally present. It's based on, it's like an it depends thing, which we don't like that response. We like those hard and fast rules. So I guess this is difficult.
I know.
It's like to do.
Give me the five steps, and it's like, oh, I wish, but it's like, right, it's so much more nuanced than that. It's sort of reconnecting with our body and hearing, because our body's pretty good at telling us, like, hey, this is what I need and this is what makes sense. But I know for me, when I'm caught in anxiety, there tends to be just such a big disconnect. And like what my body needs and what my idea of what I need in that moment tend to be two different things.
Yeah. And the last skill that I often use is just checking in of asking myself, like, is this in my control? Because I found that particularly when it comes to folks who tend to have very busy minds, tend to do the plan, over planning, over analyzing, to-do lists, problem solving, is we're putting a lot of effort into things that aren't within our control. Yeah. This could be other people, because as much as we would want to, like, you know, we might be like, if they just did this thing I told them to, everything would be fine.
Everything would be fine. And I know for me, sometimes, like, I like that question, because I think it brings a level of awareness I know I often don't have. Like, I love a good list making. And sometimes I just don't even recognize, hey, I'm feeling out of control. And that's why I'm sort of, sometimes a to-do list is helpful. But I know for me, if I'm doing it from a place of seeking control, it starts to feel gross and tense and tight. And I don't even recognize, like, oh yeah, I'm not in control here. And I'm doing this to seek control. Sometimes I just don't even recognize that that's happening. So I like this sort of skill of asking, hey, do I have control here? Or what piece do I have control over? And just because sometimes it's so habitual and so reactive, like, just sort of knowing can change the trajectory.
Yes. And that's our whole goal here, right? Our goal is to interrupt a pattern where we experience something and we react before we even notice it. And a good example of this, so you mentioned the to-do list. That's a great example. For example, if you're experiencing panic attacks, you might try to control your breathing, having this deep breathing, which ends up leading you to hyperventilate and escalate. But an example that I think everyone's had before is if you've ever taken a snack to go watch TV. And you're eating, and all of a sudden you look down and you're like, who ate all my pretzels? where did my pretzels go? Right, because we're doing it without any conscious awareness. We have a craving for food, and we're just like, you know, it's like a little robot that's just programmed, like, pick up pretzel, put in milk.
Right, yep.
On repeat. And so these patterns happen in our head also. I mentioned that, like, you know, busy mind rabbit hole that we jump down. That first what if thought, we might not be able to control. It might just pop into our head, right? What if I get a negative test result back? Yeah. But then the thoughts that come after that, the like, well, what if this happens and I'll fail out of this, or I won't be able to do this, or this horrible thing will happen. What about my insurance or paying for this? All of those thoughts are, I don't want to say they're choices, because at the time we're just reacting to, like, a default. They're mindless, unconscious choices, but that part we can interrupt. So we have this initial thought or this initial feeling, and then we have a reaction to it. And what we want to be able to do is notice the whole piece, notice this pattern. I have a worksheet that I use with clients. And if folks go to busymindreboot.com and you can sign up for my newsletter. I have worksheets there, but you don't need the worksheet to do it, but if you're interested in it. But it's a way to get all of that stuff on paper. So on the bottom right are, like, your values, so the who and the what that matter to you, qualities or characteristics you want to be about. On the left are those thoughts, feelings, memories, physical sensations that show up, and before we even know it, kind of drag us off in a direction different than where we would normally choose. I call these hooks because we don't get to choose whether we have hooks, but once we bite hooks, we no longer get to choose what happens.
Yep.
And then, you know, the top left is, well, when you bite that hook, what happens? Do I eat without paying attention? Do I procrastinate and use a magic eraser on our walls? Do I write out endless to-do lists or come up with a plan in my head I've noticed that there's this tendency these days to try to like understand what's happening in this very like intellectual, rational type space.
I know, trying to intellect our emotional experience.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, if I just understand, then I can do something about it. And it's like,
yep.
I don't know if that sequence works the way that you think it does. Notice how it works. And I think an important piece to acknowledge is if you are feeling frustrated with yourself or you have started developing this awareness that like, oh, like I keep doing this and I want to stop. Giving yourself a little grace, a little compassion to know that there's a reason why reacting in this way is so easy and effortless and reinforcing. It's helping you escape something uncomfortable. And honestly, it's responding to signals in your mind, overactive, not helpful signals, but signals in your mind that are saying like something's really wrong, fix it.
Yeah.
And if we've been like, you know, I'm 30 years old. I have, let's say, a 20-year learning history. It's going to take a little bit of time to notice what are your specific patterns? Where are you getting caught up? And then being able to pause and choose a different reaction. And so if that frustration comes up, just know that that's normal. And don't use that as another thing to then beat yourself up and get more caught in that cycle.
Yeah, I like the compassion piece. I think that's so lacking for so many of us. And I know for me, it ended up playing a really big role that I sort of underestimated, to be honest, mm-hmm. like really underestimated that sort of compassionate, flexible piece, because I was like, no, I need to like shame and beat myself into a better version. Like it was incomprehensible for me to like accept that kindness would be really effective and skillful. And again, through experiential learning and that experiential neuroplasticity, I feel much different now. But I think that piece is often underestimated and overlooked, and because it has so many preconceived notions about what self-compassion is, like ooey-gooey, self-indulgent, and really it's just skillful. It's just like a practical skill, you know, like if you're really tired and you have 10 minutes to lay down and take a nap, like end of story. It doesn't have to be, you know, ooey gooey. Like it's just doing what makes sense and supporting ourselves. Right. Like it's
exactly right. It doesn't like, I have some clients who will do like Kristen Neff has the like, you know,
right.
Hand on your heart. And some people really connect with it. And some people look at me like there's no way
I'm doing that. Yeah.
That
connects with me. It works for me, but I've had some clients that are like, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm not putting my hand on my heart. And I'm like, I get it. That's fine. Like,
we'll do it now, but I'm just letting you know, I'm not practicing this over the week. Yeah. Fair enough. Thanks for telling me. Let's do something different. But there's this underlying belief that I think has permeated into our society and our culture that like, if we're not hard on ourselves, if we don't like constantly keep up on ourselves, then we're going to turn into like the laziest slob.
Complacent.
Ever.
I know.
We're just going to sleep for 15 hours a day and eat whatever.
And binge watch for 12 hours. Like that was my fear. That's why self-compassion was so scary for me, because it was exactly that. Like that was my fear. Yeah.
Yeah. And all it does, like you, if it were the case that being hard on yourself to the point of bullying was necessary to achieve anything, when your friend, sibling, child, coworker came to you to ask for advice, you would be nasty to them.
Yes. Right. If that was what really made sense, exactly. But we've done, right. We usually drop into empathy, right? Connection mode. And yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
I like that. Keep that in mind. I always keep that in mind. Like, you really care about your friends, but when they come to you and they're really struggling, like, you don't tell them how they're not trying hard enough.
Yeah, like, you're a failure. You need to shape up here, or ship out. Like, we would never
others
say that.
Have it way worse. Just get over it. Yeah, like, never say that in a million years. And if I did say that to a friend, I hope that friend would stop being friends with me. I know,
yeah. Oh, that's a great way to put it. So can you remind us again, where can we find you? I know you just shared your website, but share it with us again.
Yeah, absolutely. So the best place to find me is on Instagram at BusyMindPsychologist. And then I also have a website, BusyMind Reboot. And I am also in the next month or two transitioning over to my new website, BusyMindPsychologist. So if you are listening to this a couple months down the road and BusyMind Reboot takes you to some therapy page, keep in mind that those resources are still available. They're just on BusyMindPsychologist. But yeah, on Instagram, and I also have all the links in my bio of where my website is and different stuff like that.
And it looks like you offer a course on your website as well.
Yes.
In case people are really interested, you know, in this conversation, I'm sure they will be and want to sort of further work with you in a way, like they can access this course.
Yes. Thank you for reminding me. I am terrible at self-promotion as many therapists are. Yes. I have a 30-day course, Busy Mind Reboot, 30 Days to Your Best Self. And essentially it walks you through how to build up this skill and how to build up this framework and approach to your life so that you can get unstuck from your busy mind and start moving towards your best self, living a more fulfilling life. So every day you get a 10-minute video, a 10-minute meditation practice, and then a lock screen image for your phone that has a question on it that will prompt you throughout the day to pay attention to a certain skill that we're building at that time. And you can find all of that information. It's super affordable. You can find all of that information on my website.
Oh, well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I can't believe the time has gone by so quickly. I have so much fun talking about all of this. I appreciate you creating the space for it. And I love your podcast. So I'm happy to be a part of it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I know this is going to be a really valuable conversation and said this at the beginning. Like, I know this will be valuable for others, but at the very least, it was super valuable for me. So thank you. So that's our episode. Thanks so much for tuning in today. If you're enjoying the show, please subscribe and take a minute to write a review on iTunes so that we can reach and support more people. If you're looking for more resources like one-on-one coaching or have a question you'd like answered on the show, please visit notanotheranxietyshow.com. And until next time, remember, be kind to yourself.